This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to David Brady, professor of public policy and director of the Blum Initiative on Global and Regional Poverty at the University of California, Riverside. David is the author of Rich Democracies, Poor People, How Politics Explain Poverty from Oxford University Press. And more recently, he's been working on the risk of poverty across the developed world and has a new AJS paper hot off the presses, Rethinking Risks of Poverty, a framework for analyzing prevalences and penalties. Thank you for joining us, David.
My pleasure.
David, I want to start off by saying I loved your paper. It was it's a great paper that I think strikes at the core of a central premise of policymaking. And I thought you could kick it off by telling us what it's about.
Well, so we try to think about these risks of poverty, and there's four big risks of poverty at the individual level: unemployment, low education, single motherhood, and young headship. And so much poverty research and poverty policy is about correcting these risks, trying to get poor people to stop having kids out of wedlock, forming households at a young age, fail to finish schooling, and fail to be employed. And we argue that this has really been the central focus of American poverty research in particular. And when you really analyze these risks and look at how much they're really, how many people really are in these risk categories, what we call prevalences, and how much these categories are associated with poverty, what we call penalties, you've come up with some pretty surprising conclusions. And so we argue that these risks are not really where we should be focusing our attention if we want to understand what causes poverty.
Hear, hear, yeah.
I thought that your paper had some very interesting comments on U.S. policy in particular. Would you be able to give us a little bit of that?
Well, I mean, one thing I could say would be that, like, it's striking when you really look at it carefully how the United States actually has below average prevalences of these risks. Mm. We have this impression in America that the problem of poverty is caused by we have too much single parenthood, too much low education, too much unemployment, and so forth. But when you compare us to other countries or even to the United States in the past, we're actually below average on these prevalences. Mm. We don't have that many people in single parent households. We don't have that many people that fail to finish high school. We don't have that many people that lack employment in their household and so forth. So I think that was a big surprise, is that if we think we can reduce poverty by fixing the poor people's behavior and their risk behaviors, we're mistaken. We're just, there's not enough there to reduce that you could really substantially move the amount of poverty in society. And so we do these simulations. Like, we show, what if you could go backwards in time and go back to when single parenthood was much lower? And would poverty be much lower? And we find, no, not at all. In fact, we do a simulation that shows if you completely eliminated single motherhood in American society, the U.S. would still have the second highest poverty amongst the rich democracies. Hmm. So you just can't move the needle very much by manipulating these risks. And similarly, we show that, you know, the U.S. actually has pretty good educational attainment compared to other rich democracies. There's pretty high levels of employment compared to other rich democracies. So if we assume
that— I have two clarifying questions. Number one, are you defining single parenthood as unmarried parenthood, or are you defining it as, you know, only one adult in the household? And second of all, is this pre-TNT or post-TNT?
David, can you explain what TNT or taxes and transfers are?
Yeah, so all of that saying is that you should measure income as what they call disposable income, which is the actual economic resources people actually have disposable to them. And if you're going to do that, you have to factor in the taxes they're paying out and the transfers they're getting in. That's the real income. Everybody lives in a post-tax and transfer world. No one lives in a pre-tax and transfer world. And so we often refer to that as TNT or tax and transfers. Actually, I don't know, aside from Gabriel, if anyone actually calls it TNT.
I constantly say that, and people always ask me what I mean. So,
yeah, as an income and poverty researcher, I honestly have not heard it called TNT, but I think of it as just disposable income. So, I mean, the way to think of it is, if you want to measure poverty, you want to measure resources as comprehensively as you possibly can, right? And even so, even with what we're doing, which we think is pretty state of the art, you know, we're not measuring the taxes that people pay in consumption taxes or in value added taxes, and so we still miss indirect taxation, but we're getting the direct taxation that affects the money that shows up in the bank for families and households. Everything is post TNT, which is really the only way you should do it. But secondly, but
especially if you're interested in policy as a mechanism, right? Because it drives me crazy when people are like, "Oh, we need to solve poverty with tax and transfers," and then their measure of poverty is pre TNT.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't be. No one should be measuring anything pre TNT. That's like this sort of abstraction we got addicted to in poverty research, and it's not a good measure. You know, just I can talk about that. Well, let me just say one thing about that. Every time we estimate pre-TNT, pre-tax and transfer, you're assuming there's no behavioral response to taxes and transfers. In other words, you're saying that if we took away taxes and transfers, their employment levels, their earnings levels would not respond. So it's a simulation of what your earnings would be if you didn't have taxes and transfers. But of course, everybody earns partly in response to knowing what their taxes and transfers are going to be. So for example, we earn a certain amount in the labor market knowing we have Social Security to protect our economic security in old age, right? We know this, and we would behave differently in the labor market and how we constitute our families when we stopped working if we didn't have Social Security available. So,
well, the big one is disability, where, you know, if you have people who are earning very little, they could, you know, there is a certain amount of endogeneity to disability, and that you can define yourself as disabled if you're really just a very low wage worker.
Yeah, although disability is like kind of a tricky one because it's actually extraordinarily difficult to qualify for disability insurance in the United States. So people talk about disability a lot, they study it a lot, and it's true disability insurance has increased in recent decades in the U.S., but it's still a really, really small share of the population, and it's still extremely difficult.
And a lot of the Northern European democracies.
Like yeah, that's true. Netherlands, for example. That's true. But I mean, I would say, I mean, you know, I just think American poverty researchers, and not just American policymakers, we tend to criticize Congress or politicians or commentators how they talk about it. But even American poverty researchers have been pretty singularly obsessed with the risk behavior of poor people. And my argument is that if you look at this in a more macro perspective, there's just not enough room there to significantly reduce poverty.
So if I try to convert your findings into a non-specialist language, what I'm understanding is you're saying that the idea that welfare perpetuates poverty because it encourages people not to get a job or to go ahead and have kids without thinking about the consequences, that whole idea that we can stop poverty by creating disincentives, by making it hard to not work or making it posing challenges or problems for people who have kids young or out of marriage. You're saying that even though it might discourage those behaviors by undercutting the welfare state, by undercutting social services, more people are going to be poor despite the fact that they might make the right choices, and making the wrong choices really makes people poor. Is that the basic thrust of what you're arguing?
Yeah, I agree with that, but I don't even believe that there's much incentive effect at all. Okay, so one of the things we do is we measure the penalties. So if you're a single mother, how much does that increase your probability of being poor? And we argue in the paper that's actually a pretty good measure of the disincentive effect, right? So if you know you're very likely to be poor if you become a single mother, that's going to be a powerful disincentive from being a single mother, right? Because that factors in not only the welfare benefits, but all the bases of your economic insecurity, your ability to get a job and so forth. So if you know that if you don't work, if you're an unemployed household, that you're definitely going to be poor, that's a powerful disincentive to being unemployed. So first of all, we have a pretty good way to measure these disincentives, better than measuring, say, the generosity of policies. Secondly, I'd say the overwhelming consensus in the science literature these days is that these disincentive effects are very small and mostly non-existent. The fact that we still talk about it is really the problem. I've argued that like the obsession with disincentives is kind of like climate change denial. The science has never been there. The science is not good. And so there's never been people that have convincingly shown that people become poor because of a generous welfare benefit or some sort of dependency. That evidence has always been weak. Last but not least, we show in the paper that there's a strong penalty to single motherhood, discourages single motherhood or low education, young headship or unemployment. If there was a tight negative association between the penalty and the prevalence, you would see a strong negative correlation, but you don't see that cross-nationally. Tons of countries have very little penalty for these risks and still have low prevalences. And similarly, countries have very high penalties for these risks, like the United States penalizes the hell out of single mothers, but we still have a fairly large share of single mothers compared to other rich democracies. So there's no correspondence between how much you get penalized if you fall into these categories and how much people are likely to fall into these categories.
Why do you think that is, actually? Why do you think this unwillingness to let go of focusing on these specific behaviors of poor people, rather than actually saying, why don't we like zoom out a little bit and look a little bit at structure, right? And look a little bit, right, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's lots of good arguments out there about why we label the poor this way or try to fix the poor or focus on their individual behavior. I've made arguments about this, but so have many others. You know, Michael Katz writes about this in The Undeserving Poor. Mark Rank has a nice book on this. So like lots of good arguments exist. And part of it's about race, part of it's about gender, part of it's about sort of the individualism of American society. But I would put some of the blame on American poverty researchers in that this is an extremely, extremely ethnocentric field. American poverty researchers start and only study the United States, and then they don't have a perspective of how other countries do it, and they fail to see that what we believe to be true doesn't hold in most other settings. And so then that kind of feeds itself. And I think, you know, one of the problems is just American poverty research is just too parochial. And, you know, this is, and I would say this is the case in economics and psychology, but I actually think it's much worse in sociology. Sociology is extremely and exclusively focused on the United States when it studies poverty. So I think that's a major source of the problem, is that we don't have a comparative perspective. And for example, you know, we talk about this in the paper. There's large literatures on welfare reform, on fragile families, on the culture of poverty that just seems completely unaware of research on poverty in other countries. And if they were aware, they wouldn't make some of the empirical claims they make very routinely.
I have a little pet theory about that, because that's something that I've felt in my research and my interactions with Americans. And I feel like when you are dealing with Europeans or Canadians, research has a more pragmatic view, where you have a problem and you realize that maybe, you know, there's going to be some type of government program that you don't want to go too far on, but you don't want to have no government programs. And I feel like the way to bubble through or break through the clutter in U.S. society is to have very simple, extreme ideological arguments. Like, it's always a battle for socialism versus capitalism here, as if, you know, there's a pure version of either in existence, and as if either would be like a feasible way of organizing a society. What do you...
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, you're right, because in comparative social policy debates in Europe, it's almost like a debate about fine-tuning. It's like, you know, well, we don't want to make the disincentives too generous, or no, we don't want to make the replacement rate too low. It's not about whether we should have these, you know, benefits at all. Right. And so this, yeah, you're right. Americans very, very much make it an ideological debate. But I don't know that that explains why American poverty researchers only look at them at the United States. That one, I think, is sort of a parallel or interacting problem, because, I mean, there are plenty of fields of social science where we're pretty international, but American poverty research is not one of them. Well, so I don't know.
Is it partly because we keep using the same line of how, well, you know, the United States is much more heterogeneous, we're much larger, right? And, you know, the whole, like, American exceptionalism is, I mean, I think that that's a line that people have been using in the social sciences for a very long time, to not look outside of the United States, and even poo-poo at Canada, which really isn't that, I mean, it's different, but it's not that different.
That's a good point. I mean, but that doesn't, that's true. And I think that's right. And it's, you know, and that I think you would agree that the United States isn't actually as, you know, much more heterogeneous than several different countries. There's lots of diverse countries and rich democracies, and several that have larger immigrant shares than we do, several that are multilingual, for example, more than we are, Canada, for example. So there's lots of heterogeneity in rich democracies. It's a bit of a myth to say that Northern Europe is exclusively homogeneously white. That's just not true. But secondly, I think what's interesting, Leslie, is that might work as an excuse in American poverty research, but then why do we have all these other fields of scholarship where it's totally understood you need to be international, you need to be comparative? Moreover, why is it American sociology is so ethnocentric about the U.S., but American economics is less so? Why is demography more international than, say, poverty scholarship within American sociology? And so that cross-disciplinary and cross-field heterogeneity in parochialism is interesting as well.
Do you think
right?
that some of it has to do with the difficulty of comparing poverty across societies, like with available data?
I bet it's not difficult, right? We've made enormous strides since what? The Luxembourg Income Study has been up and running since the late 80s. The science of poverty measurement, the science of international comparison of income is a really, really robust field. There's tons of smart people working on it. There's journals about it. There's even this thing called the Canberra Consensus, where the United Nations convened a group of income poverty researchers on basic standards of how to measure income. So there's lots of international cooperation. So I don't think it's that hard. We actually have, I think, a pretty good science of how to measure poverty comparatively. There's still debates, like how do you measure poverty in poor countries versus rich countries? But we actually are making much more progress on income and poverty measurement cross-nationally than we do in many other fields.
What's the public reception been of your, when you've presented these findings to non-specialists, what's the reaction been?
I don't think I've had much of an audience with non-specialists. I presented it to different kinds of audiences. The Europeans think, well, this is obvious. We already knew this. The economists think like, well, yeah, but none of this is causally identified. And the sociologists think like, you know, quit shaming us for being obsessed with, you know, the one slice of poverty we study, you know? And so American sociologists are, I don't know what they think about it. I'll give one story on this regard, is that I went up to, there was a very, very prominent sociological poverty researcher that presented at my former employer. And this person spoke about a group that was one of these risk groups. And I went up to this person and said, yeah, but what if they were born in Sweden? What would have happened if they were born in Sweden? Just to have the counterfactual comparison. And this person thought I was kidding and just burst into laughter. And I said, no, I'm serious. Like, actually, what if, would your findings hold? And it just doesn't occur to them to think about other countries. So I think American sociological poverty researchers are too focused only on the United States. I'd even go further. I think they're too focused on poverty in inner city communities in the upper Midwest and northeastern cities. And they don't even study, you know, I mean, that's really the
sort of attacking specific scholars.
No, I'm not, because that's the entire field. That's pretty much the entire field, right? Is that they're really, really fixated on Chicago and some northeastern cities. They don't,
you're right. I mean, you don't hear that much about poverty in Los Angeles, even though poverty is a severe problem here. And in fact, like this was like a small item in the news, but one of these massive fires that shut down a fair amount of West Los Angeles last week was caused by a homeless cooking fire.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, like one of the areas of poverty research where there's actually a thin amount of literature is on immigrant poverty. And that's really relevant and important here in this part of the country, Gabe. But I mean, you don't see much research on that. You don't see as much research on Appalachia as you do on Chicago. You don't see as much research on what, you know, the South has more poverty than the North by a large margin, but you wouldn't know that from the way we study poverty in the United States in sociology specifically.
So I have a question about how to think about this. So again, to alienate our non-quant listeners yet again, with our showing off our knowledge of fancy models, like if you look at like a Cox model, which I'm generally not a fan of, but I'm just using it as an example, the assumption is that things happen at certain times. And the only question, we know that somebody dies on this day and somebody dies on that day and somebody dies on that day. And the only question is, who does it happen to the first time? Who does it happen to the second time? Who does it happen to the third time? So would it be a good way to think about it in terms of kind of analogous to that, in that the overall macro TNT welfare state, whatever, structures society such that you're going to have a certain poverty level, and then all these like individual factors about single mothers and whatever, it applies to whom does it happen?
Yeah.
But the big, you know, so those individual factors can – you know, so the macro stuff will determine that. I have no idea what the right number is, but let's say 20% of the population is going to be poor. And then those micro factors say who's in that 20%. Or is that the wrong way to think about it?
No, that's not wrong. I mean, you know, Mark Rank has this nice metaphor. He says, you know, you should think of poverty like a game of musical chairs, and that the problem is we don't have enough chairs. And so somebody's going to be, you know, stuck without a chair. And yeah, there's probably individual characteristics that predict who's not going to get a chair. The slower person, the person not paying as close of attention to chairs, and so forth, you know. And similarly, there's going to be somebody that's going to be left out of the system if the system is built – to basically ensure 15 to 20% of people are going to be poor. Now, that said, though, if we agree to that argument, and I do agree generally with your point, Gabriel, but that does mean we can't explain the big differences in poverty, the big cross-national and historical differences, and we can't address the challenge of lowering the amount of poverty in society by playing with the individual characteristics that predict who is likely to be poor. Moreover, the second issue is that it's surprising how unreliable those characteristics are across countries. So for example, you know, single motherhood is the one that American poverty researchers study the most, right? So it's sort of an easy one to fixate on. But the coefficient for single motherhood is only statistically significant in 13 of 29 rich democracies in our study. So in the majority of countries, being a single mother does not actually significantly predict who's poor. So even those risks, who's going to be poor, are pretty unreliable predictors across contexts. And so that then...
Statistical significance as a measure of effect size. Are the sample sizes relatively big in each context?
They're plenty big. Yeah. So we talk about,
so
for example,
really measuring a weak effect, not just a small sample size.
Yeah, it's definitely not that. And you could just look at the magnitude of the coefficient. So you could look at what we call the penalties and just compare the magnitudes of the penalties. And the single motherhood penalties are surprisingly small in many rich democracies, but they're also statistically significant. And yeah, we have huge case. I mean, we had tons of data. So we got millions of data points.
Okay,
that's not our problem.
And why is that? Is that an aggressive welfare state?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, I give the example, like one that's come out, and I did a paper in demography with Rebecca Burroway about 5 years ago. We showed that, you know, it doesn't appear that single mothers are more likely to be poor in Denmark, for example. And so it's social policy, yeah. It's a political choice to provide benefits and financial support to children in general. And the corollary consequence of that is that single mothers are not economically insecure. Or not as much so.
I have very mixed feelings about a relative poverty measure. It seems like over the long run, it's intuitively the only way to do it, right? That it would be absurd to not use a relative measure to measure poverty in the Roman Empire versus today.
Wait. You mean that you would not use a relative measure, or would you use a relative measure?
No, that you'd have to.
Yeah, I see what
you're
saying. So
you wouldn't want to say that the Emperor Tiberius was poor because he didn't have indoor plumbing.
Right, correct.
Yeah, but you can also – no, but that's not true, because you can also say that, like, I do have indoor plumbing, thus I live much better than the Emperor Tiberius, and he was poor compared to me.
Yeah. Gabriel, I know that you're a little skeptical of these relative measures. So can we talk about that right away? Because that's a classic issue where sociologists raise skepticism. Interestingly, economists don't, and demographers don't usually as well. But it is a classic issue. So let's talk about that. Is that okay if we talk a little bit?
Yeah, and I want to be clear. I don't think it's wrong. I just have mixed feelings. And it's like, if I look at it closing my left eye, it looks like the right idea. And if I look at it closing my right eye, it seems like the wrong idea.
Okay, well, like, I'll give you easy reasons, and then I'll give you like a more thought out reason for why we should almost always measure poverty relatively. So the easy stuff is that there's no defensible absolute alternative that has emerged. So no one has come up with a good absolute measure that I trust. And I, like, in my 2000,
you're not a fan of triple.
Oh, like in my book in 2009, like, I go through some of the alternatives and they just look absurd on their face.
I agree that something like, how much does it cost for food, and let's triple that is a bad idea.
None of that makes sense. Okay. Well, so there's that. It's relative deprivation is probably a better predictor of life chances. There's good evidence that it's more valid for leading conceptualizations of poverty, like capability deprivation or social exclusion. And like you said, it's more reliable and realistic when you're comparing across societies. But let's look at the best reason to measure poverty relatively, okay, is that here's a clear definition of poverty that I think you'll agree with. Poverty is a shortage of resources relative to needs, right? We agree with that. Okay. And we can talk about how to measure resources, but I think we'd agree you'd want to measure those as comprehensively as you can, right? So you want the best measure of resources you've got. Okay. So now when we think of its resources relative to needs, you have to define needs relatively. And you don't have to, but it's really hard to sustain a definition of needs that isn't cultural, historical, and institutionally contextualized. And think, as a sociologist that studies culture, I don't think you would define needs separate from a cultural and historical context, right? And so if that's the case, then you have to use a relative measure.
I want to agree with you in part, and just say that this is partly an issue of intuition, in that intuitively, so like 10 years ago, what I intuitively have defined having a smartphone as a need. I would have said, no, that's a luxury. And basically because I didn't have one yet. And then 5 years ago, I had a smartphone, but I'd only recently gotten one. And so I still wouldn't define it as a need because I still saw it as more or less a luxury, but one that I myself had attained. But it would strike me as absurd that just because I now had a smartphone that somebody else who was just on the cusp of being poor is now poor because they don't. In 10 years, it would be absurd to say that, you know, somebody could be non-poor and lack a smartphone, right? I mean, it just seemed like this is like a basic thing and it's relatively cheap.
Yeah, so you're defining needs based on the cultural and historical context, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
a... And so if you do that, you're using a relative measure of poverty.
I'm saying disagree with you, not to dispute you, right? And what I'm basically saying is that my own intuitions are almost not... that we should define poverty as half the median, but almost like we should define poverty as half the median from 10 years ago. And I know that makes no sense. I'm just telling you, that's my intuition.
No, I think, and you know, I would acknowledge and even celebrate the fact that half the median is a crude approximation. Why is it half? Why is it not 60% of the median? It's just because you want to tie the benchmark at one place, and that's a perfectly reasonable one. And I like putting it at 50 because it makes clear that you're making an explicit choice. It makes your assumption explicit. Now,
it also makes the arithmetic.
Yeah, more importantly.
I've submitted a lot of papers with these relative measures of poverty over the years, and I don't think I've ever once not had a reviewer say, why don't you show it to me with 40%? Why not 60%? Why not 70%? So it got to the point where almost mechanically we write appendices where we just vary the threshold over and over again to make them stop, you know, which I think you can sympathize with, Gabriel. But I think, as long as we're thinking of poverty as a shortage of resources relative to needs, I don't know any coherent sociologist that would define needs absent cultural and historical context.
I want to make another argument in your favor, which is, you listed relative deprivation, but I would also include something that's not exactly relative deprivation, but kind of close, which is positional goods.
Sure.
And I would include economic segregation as a positional good, right? If there are spillovers from your peers, then being able to choose the peers you want as, you know, basically a high income or a high social class peer group, then that's a positional good. And that's probably a pretty important. It's inherently wrong.
And let's be clear. I mean, like, poverty scholars have thought about this for a long time. Even Adam Smith, you know, talked of poverty as a matter of like not having the cultural customs of your time being perceived as indecent. And he gave the example of like appearing in public without shame was the definition of poverty. And he said, like, if you lacked a linen shirt in a society like his, where having a linen shirt was one of the ways to appear in public without shame, then you would be poor. Mm-hmm. And Anthony Atkinson gave the example, like in the 80s, he gave the example of not having a phone would be a way to be poor. If you couldn't afford a phone because you couldn't get a job and you couldn't, you know, get healthcare access without access to a phone. So, I mean, if you really think about it carefully, it's hard to think of poverty without a culturally and historically contextualized definition of need. Now, that said, I should say this paper doesn't depend on any of that. You could change the threshold, and it's just going to change the prevalent. It's going to change the coefficients, but it's going to change the coefficients in similar ways across countries. You know what I mean? So
change the threshold from 50% of the median to 40% of the median, or you can change the threshold.
It may shuffle the countries a little bit, but the major conclusions of the paper that the United States has a relatively below average prevalence of these risks. Actually, the U.S. is not looking bad on the prevalence of these risks. And what's unusual is that the United States has by far the worst penalties attached to these risks. That pattern's going to hold if you go to 40 or 60% because we had to do it for the reviewers. So, you know, that's not where the action is in this paper, I should say.
I do think that there is an absolute poverty standard that you can spell it.
Where is it, Joe?
Well, in my own book, I don't do a systemic study like you do with thresholds, but conceptually, the way I thought of it was anything that lessens your health, shortens your lifespan, or prevents you or makes it harder for you to attain some level of economic independence. And there are –
Yeah, but all of those are cultural – those are all relative to the consumption standards of American society, right?
Well, health is not – like that's just how many years do you live and, you know, your morbidity and all that. You're right though that it is contingent on the demands of the economy in which you're set. and it's contingent on how your society distributes the goods that you need to stay alive and stay indoors. So there is some type of...
Yeah, Joe, I agree with you. And I think actually we would agree on this. So Amartya Sen has this idea of like there's an absolutist core to poverty. Mm-hmm. And what he means is it's not in economic resources, it's in well-being or in purchasing capability. And so what you're saying is that well-being is low, but I would say it's the shortage of resources that, like Sen says, that resources purchase well-being, but well-being is different from resources. And I'm taught poverty is a matter of resources. Well-being is what you purchase or you are unable to purchase if you're poor. So I agree that there's this absolutist core of well-being or capability, but I think when you define poverty, you have to define it relatively to figure out who can't purchase that well-being.
Can you give us for our listeners who are not attuned to how other societies organize their social systems, can you give us a taste of how America does differ from Europe?
On what? On social policy?
Like, yeah, on social policy. Like how does the – can you give us some broad characterization of, for example, how the German social safety net would differ from the American one?
Oh, it's hard. And I think we often do give the comparison. I've written this paper a bunch about, you know, the U.S. is very different from everybody else. And that's true. But it's also important to acknowledge that there's really big differences amongst all rich democracies. And it's probably best to think of rich democracies as a ring on a continuum rather than like a binary of the U.S. versus everybody else, right? Because there's some European countries like Spain and, trying to think of another country. There's certain rich democracies that don't do a phenomenal job for the poor either. The U.S. isn't alone in this.
Canada is like that.
Israel does a very poor job for the poor these days as well. And I would always say that, you know, the welfare state works because it's this complex of integrated programs, which, by the way, makes it really hard to causally identify because it's a whole bunch of different social policies that are interacting with each other in organic ways that collectively and holistically create a different economic playing field for workers and for poor people and so forth. But some obvious ones, I mean, big, big differences would be the provision of healthcare. I mean, so that's free, it's widely available, it is cheap. Okay. I give the example that I had one kid in the United States and I had another kid in Germany. And so I ran kind of a natural experiment. And, you know, the quality of prenatal care was very similar in both places. And the experience in the hospital was very, very similar. But in the United States, once you're done, you've had the baby, you go home, you come back for these doctor checkups. And since your kid always has the cold, you have to keep going back. But in Germany, what they would do is they would send what they called a midwife, and she would just come to your apartment all the time to check on you. So they do these in-home visits, and they would see your living conditions, they'd address your needs, they'd attend to both the mother and the child, and they did all kinds of things right there for you. So you didn't have the stress of going to the doctor's clinic, but they also are intervening in everybody's everyday lives to see how the children are living. And this is a really cost-effective intervention that we could do here in the United States, and we just politically choose not to, but it would make a big difference. It would certainly reduce our infant mortality, and it would definitely improve infant health, and it would probably improve everybody's well-being in many ways. Other examples, if you're in Germany, for example, you get a child benefit. So if you have a kid, you just get a check in the mail. It's automatically guaranteed, regardless of income. It's not means tested, and everyone gets it. And you know, that's a way to say the society has decided we're just going to provide economic resources to the children regardless. We don't care whether they're low or high income. We just view children as a resource worth investing in. And so that's a cost-effective intervention as well. But we don't do that because politically it's not supported here in the United States. So those are two good examples. But it layers throughout everything. I mean, it's in the unemployment benefits. It's in the, you know, old age pensions. It's in the, the cost of goods and needs. So it just sort of is an organic whole of a complex of interdependent social policies.
I know Mark Kleiman is always talking about that home nurse visit thing, and apparently there's been pilot studies in the United States, and it seems to be pretty effective here too. And then second of all, with this issue of a child allowance, that's something that Mike Lee and Marco Rubio, especially Lee, have been pushing pretty hard. although I have no idea how generous it is relative to the German program, but it is something that is seemed to be in some respects on the table, kind of a UBI for kids.
I will say just in terms of the pilot programs with the nurses, those are programs that are designed specifically for low income women of color in order to reduce both infant and maternal mortality risks. And also to ensure that, you know, we don't have early term pregnancies, and to also reduce the risk of low birth weight. And what they've found is that they've been able to actually get rid of those gaps, racial and income gaps. So just so you know. Mm-hmm.
And also think about, like, I mean, it really would be pretty cost effective. It really wouldn't be very expensive to send out midwives to every new baby, you know, for the first few months and check in on those families, go visit the home settings. It really would be cost effective. And we don't do it just because of politics. It's not resources that prevents us from doing that policy.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.